Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, Jean-Marc Grodi, and here on EWTN, we have this great opportunity once again to come together and hear a story of the good things that the Lord does in our lives, all the innumerable little ways that we noticed, some that we didn't notice, that God has used to bring us closer to Him, closer to His church, closer to the destiny for which He created us. I'm glad to be with you again tonight, and we're joined by Dr. Eric Baldwin. He's a former Calvary Chapel and Reformed. It's great to have you here tonight, Eric.
Thank you.
It's an honor to be with you and hear your story, and so thanks for sharing it with us tonight. Yeah,
thank you for having me.
I'll invite you to go way back to the beginning. Where does your journey begin?
Well, the journey starts about when I was 8 years old. I was baptized Presbyterian, and my parents, my younger brother and sister, we went to, I forget the name of it, what particular denomination, but we went there for a couple years. And then my parents divorced, and so we stopped going to church. Mm. And we basically were kind of in survival mode for a while.
Sure.
And
was there much of a faith life in the family up to that point in terms of prayer, or was it
No, it was mostly I have some memories of being at the church, you know. Yeah. Some hazy memories of singing in a Christmas production, or but I do remember being very jazzed about getting my first Bible. And a funny thing is, I'm 8 years old, I'm trying to read the King James Bible or whatnot, and I read the book of Revelation. I think I read the whole thing, didn't really understand it at the time, but at the end there's this verse about, you know, blessed is he who reads these words or something. Yeah. And so I took that as like, oh cool, I'm blessed now. Yes, 8 years old. So that was probably where I had the first seeds of faith and so on. But again, nothing much to do with God until I reconnected with a high school best friend of mine, Peyton Jones, and he shared, you know, gospel with me. He had just become a Christian through like Calvary type stuff.
Yeah.
So I, you know, missed my friends. So that's why I started going, you know. Junior high, I was very bookish and kind of a nerd, you know. And so I thought, oh, cool, I got friends now. So that was kind of why I went to church for a while. And it didn't really, I mean, I believed, but it didn't really change me fundamentally, you know, until I was about maybe 16 years old after a while. And I'd been playing in bands and with some friends from church, and I had been doing a little bit with the worship band on Friday nights at my church. And I had the Romans 12 verse where it talks about your spiritual act of worship, you know, reasonable act of service to God. And it made me think, oh, worship's not just singing. It's offering your body as a living sacrifice to God. And it's about transforming and the renewal of your mind and so on. So I took my faith a lot more seriously, stopped dabbling in the bands I was in, and went full tilt into doing worship stuff. So I would be part of the worship band on every Friday night outreach. And then maybe by the time I was 17 or so, I was playing in the church service band on Sunday mornings with the guy that was kind of helping arrange the songs and helping us with learning our parts and things like that.
Awesome.
So that was when I became Christian, really, I think.
Right.
Is during
really
that time.
Kind of took hold of it yourself.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Now, you mentioned the divorce and problem with your family. What had happened sort of your family after that point in terms of everybody else's faith lives?
It just wasn't something that was talked about.
Okay.
Until much, much later.
Gotcha.
You know, and with conversations here and there. But, you know, when you're a younger Christian, you talk to everybody about everything, you know. And so I would, you know, share with them, and they'd share with me what they believed and how they, where they were at and so on. But no, it was a me thing going to church.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah. Okay. What happened next?
High school, was okay for a few years, you know. And then when I started dating people, things kind of started to go off the rails. I realized that I was kind of confusing love for God with love that I wanted.
Yeah.
And relationships with girls were more immediate and more, I don't know, it just, that was more attractive in a lot of ways, you know, when you're young. So it's not like I put God aside, but I had this tendency to want to replace something I couldn't see with something I could see, something I couldn't touch with something I could could touch, you know. And so that, I think if it was that alone, it would be easy enough to do. But there were some various things that happened at my church involving people behaving badly, let's say, and people that were role models. And I couldn't process at the time why someone who believed these things would act this way, you know. And, of course, you got stories of David and stories of people who fall and do things that are wrong. But it was more visceral for me at this time. You know, certain things were happening in and around my circle that I just couldn't process. And that together with another series of events, a lot of my friends, I grew up in Huntington Beach, California, and there were a lot of people in my youth group that got wind of Reformed doctrines. And it was almost like there was a little schism or church break in my youth group where a lot of my friends went to join various Presbyterian groups, and they had, I think, well-founded criticisms of some of the things that were going on. Like, for example, I got baptized three times, you know, once in a pool, once at the beach, you know, and every week we do these altar call things, right? And you know, I don't know how many times I thought I was being born again through that whole series of things. You know, now looking back on that, I see the motivation for why I was doing those things. Mm-hmm. More clearly, but at the time, you know, I just thought, oh, this is what everybody did back in the early days of the church, you know, something like that. And then, but I couldn't be on board with everything that my friends were saying at the time when I'm like 16 or 17. But what that did to me was kind of give me a little bit of a skepticism, if you will, mm-hmm. about what do I really believe and why do I believe it? Because this group of friends is saying you should read the Bible this way. This group of friends is saying read it this way. And I read the text, and I don't really see either one of those things. What do I see? I don't know. That's where I was. And so a big life theme of mine has been, what do I believe and why do I believe it? Mm-hmm. And trying to sort all that out. And so I ended up kind of retreating back to practice, you know, orthopraxy rather than orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. But then, again, that went out the window later, too. partly because some other events maybe we'll get to. But
yeah.
But yeah, that's where I was at.
We underestimate that connection. Sometimes people think of, oh, I'm a real practical person, or I'm a real theoretical person, or that we think that about each other, you know. But in lots of subconscious ways, you know, the coherency or lack of coherency about our worldview, not just specific points of doctrine, but the picture mm-hmm. of the universe, of reality that our faith gives us, that connects to our integrity, our ability to kind of live out the faith confidently. And so even if we know some of the things we should do, there's connections between those two things. And so they, you know, sometimes God calls us to work on one, you know, but they're connected, and it draws us back to the questions if we haven't sort of, we have unanswered questions, you know, that we still are searching for. So, yeah. So what happened next?
Well, towards my senior year, I had a serious girlfriend, fell for her hard, and then we ended up breaking up, and I was bummed out about that, and kind of upset about that. And then went to community college for about a year. I wanted to be a music major. You know, I wanted to do all things music. My trajectory in high school was I started out honors English, then I went to college prep, then I went to regular English, so I ended up reading Beowulf like four times. but I didn't care because I was playing music and going to church every night, you know, and I was going to be a rock star. But that didn't happen. So ended up at some point I realized that I was upset at God because I hadn't forgiven or gotten over what happened with this girl and I. And I figured the way I needed to fix that was to get back with her and redeem what was lost, you know, so to speak.
Right.
So I tried my best to do that, and that didn't work. And I, you know, some things happened that really threw me for a loop, ended up getting really into a dark place, you know, feeling really down and despair and so on and so forth. But God got me through that. But it's my life was always kind of like a roller coaster, you know, because again, I didn't have any firm belief about what I believed or why I believed it, other than like bare essentials, you know. Along this time, I decided to continue on with school anyway, just because I didn't have much else better to do. And I took a philosophy class, and that just kind of changed my world a little bit. I had read C.S. Lewis, I'd read some Augustine, a bunch of stuff, Francis Schaeffer, a little bit of apologetics and theology here and there, but I had never really been presented with, at least to my understanding, somebody that was able to fully integrate faith and reason. And when I took this philosophy class, it was sort of like, here's like 8 or 9 worldviews. You know, we're just going to kind of look at them a little bit and you know, by the end of the class, see which one you like best. It's kind of what my professor did. And we looked at Confucius and, you know, Buddha and Islam, Judaism. And then, but Aquinas really rang a bell for me, you know, like, oh, cool. You know, there is at least one way to do this. And so I kind of bracketed that, you know.
Yeah.
But around the same time, I was playing some other bands and doing some other things, and but yeah. So again, it was hard for me to go to church though, because I'd be so critical of what was being told to me. And I didn't know where they were coming from half the time or what they were saying. And so,
right.
And with my philosophy training, it was too easy for me to nitpick on things. And so what I ended up doing is taking more of the. In hindsight, I would explain it this way: more of a subjectivist route. Again. Taking the principle of private interpretation to a certain place, and I ended up being influenced by, say, Karl Barth, where you identify the word not with the, well, obviously Jesus is the word incarnate, but what's primary is Jesus, and the Bible just records what Jesus said, you know, and you end up kind of looking to the person and practice of Jesus, and the Bible isn't as important all of a sudden, or this notion that you can encounter Jesus in other modalities, if you will, you know. And around about this time, I was opening myself to other religions because I just kind of thought that, well, I just kind of fell into what I believed, you know. It's not really a reason to believe this stuff. So I actively sought out other faith traditions, and then being able to experience ultimate reality through other lenses really threw me for a loop. And in particular, fast-forwarding a few years, I was gravitating towards sort of Taoist, Buddhist stuff, in particular this guy named Han Shan, who wrote this book called Cold Mountain. You know, it's kind of hermits living off in the pristine Chinese waterfall mountains, you know, and escaping, and it's a sort of picture of peace and stillness, you know, where you just sort of effortlessly act in accordance with what you're supposed to be doing. And that, to me, kind of felt a little bit like how the Holy Spirit's supposed to work through you, you know. That was my understanding at the time. So I very much broadened my perspective about what I would read devotionally or what I would learn from. So I was Christian, but I was also learning from this other stuff. But at the same time, I became more and more convinced that the Bible taught broadly reformed positions that I was really struggling with. Things like, you know, if God's decrees function a certain way, it sure looks like God's the author of sin. And I just couldn't go down that route because it's like, I've done some dumb things, you know? But it seemed that sort of lens seemed inescapable for me for a long time.
Interesting.
And that engendered a lot of anger, hostility. I get really upset and just rant at God and things like that, you know. Again, it's a sort of headspace I was in.
Now, to pause for a moment, and we're speaking tonight with Dr. Eric Baldwin, former Calvary Chapel and Reformed. And you just mentioned beginning to see some of this Reformed theology in the Bible. Now, why do you think that you were particularly seeing that? Is it because of what you're hearing around you or your background? You know, why was that coming out so clearly as a challenge to you?
What was happening was, I had it in my head that I had to figure out certain philosophical questions before I answered how to read the Bible or how to interpret it or what my theology was going to be needed to be settled. But I had to have a philosophical way of understanding what I was reading. So for whatever reason, the philosophical lens that I kind of gravitated to and some of the arguments from, you know, Luther and Calvin and other people that I had been reading and other philosophers, Charles Hodge, Francis Turretin, made me think, yeah, okay, this makes sense of these philosophical problems or this way of philosophically seeing things I sort of gravitated towards, and that became sort of a way that I would read the Bible in light of what I've now come to understand as a tradition of inquiry, right? Mm. You've got people looking at a text and trying to make sense of what it means and so on. And that was the one that seemed, at the time, more of a live option for me, you know? Right. And so that's why I read it that way. And again, there's a certain measure of authority. These people say these things about it. Here's these commentaries. Here's this tradition, especially coming from a Calvary background. We didn't have a creed to speak of. Maybe we did somewhere. I didn't know what it was. There is so much about, you know, who knows what you're going to be told on a given day is what I thought. Mm-hmm. But at least you have a confession. You have some tradition within these Presbyterian churches that my friends were going to. Mm-hmm. So I had a handle on what they believed and why they believed it. And that up until the time was the best way for me to explain or account for what had happened previously.
Gotcha.
Was this broadly reformed lens, way of looking at things. But
Well, it's interesting too, because it does seem like a lot of the reformed positions are precisely sort of taking a philosophical approach to scripture and trying to exhaust mysteries that come to us. I mean, you brought up this question of where does evil come from?
Yeah.
You know, and you can philosophically try to figure that out, you know, or how does God's foreknowledge and man's free will work?
That's
another, you know, reformed thing. It's a great mystery, and the church there guards the mystery, and it seems like some of these positions are the philosopher trying to say, no, no more mystery. We've got to have it one way or another.
Yeah, and so I remember, this is fast-running a little bit, but late 90s or whatnot, I was going to a church, and I was going through member classes with the pastor, and there's a couple passages in the Westminster Confession I just could not get on board with the way that he was explaining them. And so I said, here's what it's saying, and here's what it says, and here's what it seems to be saying. But I just couldn't get on board with it. But I was still kind of convinced that this is what the Bible teaches.
Sure. Okay.
You know, and so I was just, having a real hard time trying to reconcile those two things.
So you talked a little bit while you saw the reasons why you were finding these positions and wrestling with them. But I mean, again, share again, you know, why were they so particularly difficult for you?
Yeah. Well, the reason why is because so many things that I suffered personally, many, maybe most of which were at my own hand, but also various betrayals from other people.
Yeah.
That I just could not understand why God would allow me to be treated that way, let alone decree for the foundations of the earth that this should play out this way in all of its minute detail. So that was very existentially difficult for me. So you've got different problems of evil, like the theoretical problem of evil and the existential problem of evil. And so that existential problem of evil was really kicking my butt, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why it was such a problem for
Makes
me.
Yeah.
You know, how can I live in this mindset? I don't know how I can do it. You know, I hope that answers the question.
No, it does. Yeah, so it totally makes sense. You know, that you're seeing this in there, and it's a worldview, a theological worldview that's just not fitting your experience. And it's in a technical sense, is scandalizing you. Right. In other words, giving you an image of God, like this does not make sense of what I'm experiencing. God, is this who you are? Right.
Yeah. And then again, the reading more Aquinas. So I got my AA in philosophy. Yeah. Right.
Sure.
What it was is like I had experienced so much failure and so much stuff that just I was just upset about. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to do the most difficult thing I could possibly do with myself. I'm going to get a PhD in philosophy. As somebody who never studied in high school, I studied for Latin and geometry, and that was it, because that was hard. But so I decided to do this, and then I realized, that means I got to get a PhD. Well, that means I got to get a bachelor's, and then I got to transfer. So anyway, I ended up going to Cal State University Long Beach, where they had a bachelor's program that fed into a master's program, because with my not very impressive academic background, I felt I needed to get a master's degree in order to be a candidate to go to any grad school worth going to. So through the process of this, I had read up a lot more on Aquinas. Mm-hmm. In particular, reading up on his view of free will. And the idea that, just to be overly simple, maybe, is that God is drawing everything to Him as the ultimate end of all creation. And if we fail to respond to that, it's no part of Him, it's no fault of Him that we don't respond appropriately. The fault is we have a bent will, you know, and something to do with, like, you know, if the mind wills the stick to move the hand, I'm sorry, the mind wills the hand to move the stick, mm-hmm. it's, I'm not just a stick that God's moving around.
Right.
I'm not just, you know, the, in some sense, God's providential ordering does cause me to cause certain things, being the ultimate cause, but me as cause of my actions isn't just reducible to Him as ultimate cause. There's there's analogical stuff going on there,
right.
That I do have genuine causality that's not micro-determined by God's decree. And I just, I remember just reading this and just crying, you know, just weeping for about 10 minutes straight, you know, because like I finally could break through and see like there's a different way of looking at this. And that was really freeing. But again, it was still hard for me to, I mean, that's a philosophy, you know, but I still had, I didn't quite understand how to get beyond the lens of the Reformed tradition that I was thinking was probably true at the time.
Right.
But at least there was this way of making sense of it in a different way.
Chink in the armor.
Yeah. And that was maybe the first step on the road to eventually becoming Catholic. And this would have been about 97 or 98 or something.
Gotcha.
A good 20 years
before
it actually happened. So anyway, I ended up doing my master's degree. And because I was so interested in reading widely and being interested in so many different faith traditions and whatnot, I ended up almost by accident getting a religious studies degree because I took classes on Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism or whatever. And so I ended up doing something like comparative epistemology of religion is kind of how I build what I do. But I've always been very good at entering into, okay, here's this thinker and here's this person and where they're coming from and why they're coming from that place and kind of taking it on from the inside, if you will.
Yeah.
And not I wouldn't say role-playing, but like being a sympathetic reader and understander of what they're saying and kind of trying it on and see what it's like.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and see if this is not just making sense intellectually, but, you know, how does this play out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But around this time as well, I started to think of propositional truth as less important as being rightly related to truth, and probably because I read too much Kierkegaard, who was like my hero for a while. And so I had this sort of more relational idea of what it was to be in the truth, you know, and that's where it was in that headspace I was able to devotionally read certain Taoist and Buddhist stuff.
Right.
But then I was super confused, like, what? You know, this seems right, you know. But that kind of period didn't last too long because what I tried to do is I tried to do what's called to act spontaneously and in accord with your own nature, as I call it. Where you, in order to deal with the problems of your discriminatory mind, you just kind of don't worry about it. You know, you just kind of act in what way seems natural, but that got me into a whole bunch of trouble. Because you're just kind of like, you find yourself doing things and like, why did I do that exactly? Oh, I don't know. Let's see where it goes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a dangerous place to be in. But So anyway, I end up getting accepted to University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and I moved away from all my family and friends and experienced culture shock like I'd never known could be possible. I felt like I was on an island surrounded by a sea of corn, and I grew up in Huntington Beach, California. You know, these worlds couldn't have been any different.
Yeah.
So I just, it was very tough transition for me. Just hated being there, but I kind of felt like I needed to be there. I kind of felt like Jonah. You know, God told Jonah to go do something, and I don't want to do that. But you end up doing it anyway, you know, and end up leaving a lot of things behind that I tried to hold on to. It was really rough, you know, and the girl I was dating at the time, I was with a Muslim girl, actually, for a while. It was really hard to let go of that for a variety of reasons. But And then, so yeah, here I am in Nebraska, no friends, no nothing. And what do philosophy people do? Well, they tend to go to bars, you know. So that was really, not all of them, but a lot of them. I was kind of flailing around, and so I ended up getting involved in drinking too much, you know. And that was kind of a monkey on my back for a lot of years, you know. But by about this time, I'd taken so many of my classes so many times as in my undergrad, and I did a master's degree, and I basically had to do another master's degree at Nebraska. So I had to retake all my classes again. So I could kind of coast a little bit, so I didn't worry so much about whether or not some of this was inhibiting my studies, you know. So there's that part of the story.
Well, let's pause there. You know, you're still in the midst of this long intellectual journey, ups and downs. And it's interesting because you've got this intense intellectual journey, but you also mentioned, again, just having a very turbulent up and down sort of life. Probably a bit of temperament, a bit of just, you know, the circumstances.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But without that, but I guess it seems like it does keep that intellectual journey going for you, that you've got to find a firm place to set yourself.
Yeah, I'm in too deep. I have to see this to the end,
right.
You know.
Right.
And there's the questions I had were getting more visceral, more and more earthy, if you will, and more life or death, you know.
Yeah.
I felt like I'm living in a war, kind of, and I have to solve these problems, you know.
All right,
I have to see it to the other side.
Sounds good. We'll be back in just a couple minutes, and we'll hear the rest of Dr. Eric's story, Eric Baldwin. He's a former Calvary chaplain, Reformed, and we're going to hear the rest of the story in just a minute. I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, we have a newsletter with monthly, a new conversion story every month, and a whole archive of stories, both here on the Journey Home program as well as written testimonies and others from every conceivable background. And so check that out at chnetwork.org. You'll find something inspirational to you there. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Eric Baldwin's story. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, and we're joined by Dr. Eric Baldwin, former Calvary chaplain, Reformed, and he's been sharing his story with us. Eric, and when you left off, you know, you'd been walking us through a lot of this intellectual journey you'd been on. You'd gotten into philosophy to try to answer your questions about God and the church and which church and whether you should even be going and all that. And in some sense, you found lots of good stuff. You had this great intellectual journey, but in other ways, it just made the problem worse, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, again, part of my nature is I'm curious.
Yeah.
And I'm especially curious with people who disagree with me. And you know, thinking about counterfactuals, like, what if I was born in medieval China? You know, that would be, I'd be totally different set of things I'm worried about, you know, and concerns and a whole different starting point. And so I wanted to make sure that what I was believing wasn't just a matter of historical accident or circumstance, you know, or psychology. You know, I wanted it to be well-grounded. So that's, again, why I had to do philosophy.
Right.
And again, it wasn't enough for me just to read the Bible because, you know, anyone from anywhere can read the Bible. You know, how am I supposed to read it? Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't tell you how you're supposed to read it necessarily, right? Anywho, so I think we stopped where I was at University of Nebraska.
Right.
So I'd finished all my coursework, and I was starting to put together my dissertation committee and had picked out an advisor and so on, and just about to do all that process when my advisor told me, he pulled me into his office and he said, Eric, I'm going to be leaving University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and I'm going to be going to Notre Dame. And it just kind of dropped me like a bomb, you know. It's like, oh shoot. And then he said, well, here's your options. You can stay here, the only reason I was there was because of him. And other than that, it was a very hostile environment. Again, I'd been acting like an idiot too, and burning bridges here and there, but then trying hard to be a Christian too at the same time. Kind of this Peter following from a distance thing. You don't want to completely give it up, but you don't want to fully get on board. So I decided I needed to start over, you know, and so I ended up going to Purdue. And by about this time, this is equivalent of starting my third master's degree.
Wow.
Equivalently, because I already took one at Long Beach and I did a whole one at Nebraska, and I'm doing another one at Purdue now. And so I was able, as one nice thing about that, I was able to take classes several times. You know, like I took philosophy language probably 3 or 4 times, and get different angles on it, you know. And it also opened me up to take other classes. Like I took an Arabic philosophy class at Purdue and a grad seminar on Kierkegaard and various other things I wouldn't have been able to do.
Nice.
But my first year or so was all right. But then my second year, I started to get a little bit burned out on all this classwork, you know, and just feeling like I'm not getting anywhere. And ended up falling in with some friends playing open mic night at the Bruco. And we get up there and just, we called it Transaction Ensemble, and we would just make up songs on the spot, you know, while enjoying the beverages, you know.
Yeah.
and so things got a little bit out of control there. It was fun, though, because I was reconnecting with my love of music and still trying to do it. But again, the drinking became a big problem at around this time. Again, doing my classwork, but having these monkeys on my back, you know.
Yeah.
But then eventually I got to a point where I just couldn't do that anymore.
Right.
Various things bottomed out on me, and I realized, you know, I can't go this way anymore, but I can't stop. It took interventions from family members and friends to get me to stop pursuing that way. And it's kind of like God delivered me from that.
Mm.
And, well, obviously, yeah, this is what happened. But at the time, looking back, I appreciate it more,
yeah,
you know, but I'd really hit a wall and bottomed out, as they say. And so I, stopped doing that. And, my girlfriend at the time, we had met back when I was in Nebraska, because I mentioned having a culture shock and just being completely out of my element. So I joined a dating site, you know, try to meet people. And first put, okay, let's do that 30-mile radius Corn Island I'm on. Oh, that's not working. Let's do all Nebraska. Let's do all the United States. Or let's do the whole world, whatever, you know. And so I ended up meeting Melanie online in that way. But being... we're at like 2007 or so now, 2008, but back in 2000, there's nothing I can do about that. So we were just like pen pals and friends, you know. But around about this time, I had gotten a Purdue Research Fellowship, which basically pay you to write your dissertation. You don't have to teach, you don't have to take classes, and there's no provision about where you need to be. So I decided, well, you know, she was a part of my getting out of this mess I was in. A gift from God in that direction.
Yeah.
So I figured, well, you know, I got to make or break it, you know. So I decided to go visit the Philippines, and I was over there for about 5 weeks or so, and getting to know her more in person and better, you know. Long story short, we ended up getting married about a year later.
Mm-hmm.
It's around 2010 now. Yeah, 2010,
yeah.
April. And I ended up being a visiting graduate student at Notre Dame at the Center for Philosophy and Religion,
right,
and continuing to work on my dissertation. And job market in philosophy is just atrocious. So I ended up being at Notre Dame until 2017, about 5 years of being a contingent faculty, yearly appointments. And again, that whole time still not... God was working on me with becoming more acquainted with Catholicism, you know, being at Notre Dame and all.
Right.
But I wasn't quite ready to get on board. But philosophically, what helped me to do it was I ended up doing my dissertation on Alistair MacIntyre's Rationality of Traditions.
Mm.
And and a pivotal point was reading After Virtue. And he talks about the disquieting suggestion about morality. You know, what does justice mean? Who's justice? Who's rationality? And he's thinking about it from more of an ethical point of view, but I was thinking about it more from an epistemological point of view. But I see that there was a big overlap between the two kinds of concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So again, sort of a long story short, I ended up defending what I called a tradition-based perspectivalism in order to address the problem of fully informed, reasonable disagreement in philosophy of religion. you know, like how you could have a Muslim and a Jew and a Buddhist be fully aware of what the other person believes and why, and yet disagree with them, and know why you're doing that too. And again, the key to it for me was, well, you're going to be a member of a tradition that has a conversation over time with foundational texts and foundational ways of interpreting and understanding those texts. And that you can't approach inquiry from a vacuum or just renew or restart everything. You always are given yourself by what came before you. You are formed and shaped by things you don't even understand or know about that help to make you who you are. And it's very difficult to see where you came from because the fish doesn't see itself in the bowl, you know. But that's what I was trying to do all this time. At the end of the day, I realized, wow, you know, I've got a lot in common with Aquinas than I thought, a lot more than I thought. So basically, I became convinced of McIntyre's substantive philosophy, read Aquinas in a whole new way, and very much related to what he was doing in the project he was involved in, you know, taking all the church fathers and all the philosophers and all the science and the best objections you can come up with and trying to come up with a synthesis of what is true and good and beautiful. But I still wasn't Catholic yet,
right?
You know, but what ended up doing it and sealing the deal was I was contributing to this book on Christian religious epistemology, and I found myself just thinking like Aquinas through all of these things. I'm like, well, this is sounding pretty Catholic, you know. And my friend, who is Catholic, Tyler McNabb, said, dude, yours is more Catholic than mine, you know, and you're not even Catholic. And so we thought that was funny. But somehow through the having, you know, transferred my dissertation into a book and then writing this book chapter, I decided, wow, you know, reasons I thought not to be Catholic weren't very good.
What would some of those have been?
Well, the key point of contention, obviously, between Catholics and Protestants is the solas. Mm-hmm. The more I read about how the church came to be and the way the canon in particular came to be, I just didn't see any reason at all to get on board with any of the solas.
Sola Scriptura certainly was problematic for you because you'd been wrestling with the Bible for years.
All of my interpretations rested on certain traditions of reading the text.
Right.
And the way I grew up is like, you don't even know about the Reformation, you know. In the non-denominational setting I was in, I didn't care. Yeah. And then when I found out about it, I thought, oh, that's real Christianity, you know? And then having problems with that, but then realizing, oh, I skipped over this whole 1,500 years of church history and the conversation, you know?
Sure.
And along the way, there's always been these heroes that I had liked, you know, I was starting to realize, oh, they're Catholics, you know, Augustine. Yeah. I mean, I knew they were Catholics, but that fact was kind of like an irrelevant little trivia bit, you know? But the more I'm reading Aquinas, he's dialoguing with these people in a heavy way. And I go, wow, you know, I just opened up more to me the resources of the tradition. And then certain other, you know, more philosophical reasons that we might not be able to get into. But just this notion that I found myself belonging in that tradition of inquiry that Aquinas and McIntyre were talking about. That's what I was doing on the sidelines, if you will. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a part of that, you know, because that's kind of where I was heading.
Yeah.
So at this point, I'm kind of a crypto-Catholic anyway, because that's the kind of way I'm thinking about things. And so I asked my friend Tyler for a couple books that I ought to read. And again, the typical sorts of things and questions you have, like starting out, you know, the sacred tradition and the sacred scripture and how those things relate and certain things about the Marian dogmas and things. But it didn't take much for me to fit that into the framework that I was starting to be comfortable with.
And on the praxis side, I mean, you're presumably attending a church up to this point and you're praying and you're doing were you?
Not really.
Okay, so this is really an intellectual journey.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. My wife and I went to one of the Presbyterian churches at Notre Dame because the guys that I was with were Presbyterians. You know, Alvin Plantinga, Michael Ray, and people like that were going to this church, so that's where we went for a while. Mm-hmm. But it was a little bit on the intellectual side. Mm. And And my wife's smart, but she's like, this isn't really my thing. You know, she's an engineer, very up on things, but a lot of it was kind of going over her head, you know, and I was just going there because that, you know, that's what the philosophers here do, you know. But we had some patches where, you know, we weren't going to church or whatnot, but we'd go to church here and there. But basically, after I decided I wanted to be Catholic, that's when I started going back to church.
Gotcha.
You know, and that's why I entered into RCIA, and then we started going to Mass.
Gotcha.
You know,
right.
But about that time, it's like, yeah, I want to do this. So.
Okay. So, what did you encounter in RCAA? How'd that process go?
It was kind of like filling in little gaps,
yeah.
You know, in my understanding. Because I've taught at lots of different schools, and one of the schools I taught at was a Catholic Siena Heights University in Michigan, I believe. And I taught a social moral philosophy class, and I used a book that was Catholic social teaching and morality. And so I had sorted through a lot of that stuff already. You know, with the social teaching and so on. And it's, forgiven my background, it's hard for me to make that switch from this radical kind of thing I was doing here to this other radical thing over here, you know, a very different approach to the same subject matter as a Catholic than as a Protestant with regards to, you know, certain sexual ethic things or certain things that were surprising to me. But that was a sea change, if you will, in my thinking.
Sure. So did you follow that all the way through to Easter?
Yeah. I became a Catholic Easter 2019.
Right.
It was
a weird time to come to the church, of course.
Oh, yeah. Totally weird. Because, yeah. You know, I mean, Easter was all right, but around, what was it, November, things starting to get weird. And,
So
it was a bit of rocky at the beginning there. But I don't want to say that I was completely happy with everything because I had so many questions I was still trying to sort out. But what I realized was like, I need to work this out within the church rather than outside of it, you know, the kinds of things I was wrestling with. And when I came to realize that assenting to what the church teaches in the process of conversion is something that can happen within the church, I was free to join it, you know.
Yeah. Once you become convinced that the church is right and it's the place on the big questions, the worldview is right, Christ is there, this is his church, right? Then you can assent to that and then keep working it out. I mean, what would you say, again, you'd been through all these philosophical hurdles and questions and wrestling with the Bible and Reformed theology, you know, what would you say that the worldview that you'd settled on that allowed you to become Catholic there?
Yeah, again, it had to be an epistemological turn, if you will. Everybody treats certain things as basic sources. Well, not everybody, but I mean, by and large, and for the most part, people accept certain things to be sources of justification or evidence or whatnot. Some people will, for example, say reason alone, you know, don't be too jazzed about sense perception, Descartes, Spinoza, you know.
Yeah.
And then you got your Humes over here. No, reason isn't the way to go, sense perception. So what I ultimately came to see the disagreement between the wrestling I was having between, you know, do I be Catholic or not, was do I extend my idea of sacred tradition, you know, to include, or the idea of revelation to include things that I hadn't seen before, you know, and then accepting the role of magisterium, for example, or accepting the notion that you have a certain tradition that's not recorded in the text, you know, and ultimately certain practices and certain ways of doing things that aren't in the text. And perhaps maybe the sea change opened up for me this way. It's like, you know, Christian practice and whatnot well preceded the canon, the collection of the canon, you know, and for me, the thing that really sealed the deal was this notion that why did we decide what was included in the Bible? Well, was it used in liturgical practice?
Right.
You know, is it being taught in the churches?
Yeah. That's something I think even Catholics are not familiar with, that reality.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of the basis for what's included in the canon is what's used in worship, right?
Yeah, and then that ties back to, in an interesting way, to when I was younger with this idea of your spiritual act of worship and transforming your mind.
Right.
So worship, and I'd never given up on reading the Psalms or identifying with David and, you know, this whole time being a songwriter and a musician and pouring my heart out to God. I pray to God all the time, even in this mess I was in. But I was able to finally see that Christ, it's hard to put the words here, that the church is bigger than just what's recorded in the Bible. You know, you've got the book of Acts, but there's a lot that the Spirit does and has done and continue to do, and the book of Acts just kind of stops, but God kept going all the same. And that some of the things that come out of that don't form the church as much as what was recorded in Acts, you know.
Yeah.
In particular, you know, you got the Council of Jerusalem, right? And again, as a Protestant, I realized, okay, I accept the Nicene Creed, but then we stop. But then why did I do that? And then again, not having a good reason to stop there anymore opened me up to a lot more authorities and sources of evidence or sources of testimony, and a whole host of reasons that I could, much richer than what I had limited myself to. And that when that happened, I realized, wow, there's a lot to draw on here, you know. And again, a lot of Reformed branches will draw on a lot of this stuff too, you know, and reading the church fathers and reading them and so on. But again, that big philosophical conversation that Aquinas was having was at the same time a theological one.
Right.
It was such a rich place to play in, I could say.
Yeah.
And that I could find myself there. And continue to sort out the things that I'm thinking about, but as a part of this bigger tradition that is more representative of what I thought was really going on. So,
well, we got about 8 minutes left. It brings us up to the present. You know, what's happened since then?
Oh gosh. So, I was at University of Notre Dame until 2017, and I got my PhD in 2012, and I've been on the job market forever, and getting to phone interviews and having a few on-campus interviews, but nothing has clicked. And so I've been adjuncting in various places for a long time. And at some point that just got too difficult to do. You know, I'm just, you know, what's that verse? Throw your bread on the waters and some of it comes back to you, but nothing's coming back. It's like, well, I guess, you know, I don't know. So I haven't given up the notion or the dream of, having a tenured position somewhere, but it's way on the back burner, something I don't expect and I'm not searching for. But paradoxically, this past 5 years has been very rich research-wise. I've got 3 books out. One was my dissertation, and me and my friend Tyler co-wrote 2 books.
Cool.
A lot of book chapters, a lot of articles. While I'm adjuncting a lot and working full-time jobs, I have nothing to do with academics. So that's like, how is that happening? You know, but again, it's God sustaining it, you know, so I'm still making an academic contribution. But I kind of feel like I'm on the sidelines of that conversation, you know, so
yeah.
We'll see what happens though.
Okay. Well, just again, with a few minutes left, one thing I wanted to circle back around on is, again, much of your journey involves working out the intellectual, side of things. You know, what's the truth? How do I read scripture? How do I approach God? What's gonna get the epistemology right? Talk about how that's translated into praxis. Talk about your experience of the sacraments of the church, your family's living out of the faith now. What are some ways that you see that and practice differently?
Well, one of the things that was so difficult for me was I didn't know what I would get if I went to a church. You know, what's the personality of the pastor going to be like? What are they going to talk about? What's going on? And one of the things that was very freeing for me was, like, I knew exactly what's going to happen when I go to Mass.
Right.
This is what's going to happen. And so that was very liberating in a way. I didn't dislike going to church anymore because of those features. And, the devotional practices, you know, reading the Missal every day and you know, listening. My job allows me to listen to podcasts all day, so I'll listen to Mass, or I'll listen to Bible in the Year, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I'm still exploring a lot of the devotional paths, because I'm relatively new Catholic, and it kind of happened without. It was very intellectual conversion for me, you know. So I'm still kind of exploring what it is to be Catholic and trying to work that out. But but I'll do listen to the Rosary program too, you know, on my podcasts, and you know, pray along and things like that.
Right.
And we go to church every week now, and you know, just it's changed things in big ways and in little ways.
Right. And the journey continues too. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is it's not. It's not over. Right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one more question that I wanted to ask you, and you sort of hinted at it earlier, but I've always been interested in the question of you know, truth and the relationship between truth and our openness to it, our character. You know, like, what's the connection between the truth and, I guess, the openness of our heart, the content of our character, and our ability to get answers to those questions that we're searching for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, sometimes along the path, I had a tendency to overly intellectualize things. But a lot of the things that are working in the backgrounds, or attitudes we might have, or habits of thinking, or habits of feeling. And one thing I didn't mention so much is the reason I got into McIntyre so much is because I got sick of doing epistemology, and got sick of doing, I just didn't care about solving puzzles because they were fun. That I don't care. Right. I want to know what's going on. And so I made kind of a switch to ethics. And ethics is a whole nother mess. But I ended up falling into a neo-Aristotelian picture of things, you know, with people like Philippa Foote and Martha Nussbaum, G.E. Anscombe, and people like that. And so one of my professors turned me on to reading all of this stuff. And that opened me up to a whole nother line of inquiry in Western thought, you know, and able to see that right action is a matter of right feeling and building right habits, and it's not just following rules. And and so that whole, again, that sea change made it possible for me to read McIntyre and to be hit the way I was. And to see just, again, just a richer place to draw from. Not having it be about, again, the God's really transforming my character.
Yes.
The God's really, again, to go back to that verse in Romans 12, I didn't think I'd talk about it as much as it was so pivotal, but it talks about being transformed by the renewal of your minds. To be actually transformed, to be made more like Christ, is something that requires right feeling and right habits and so on. And so that's what I'm working on now. There's so much that I need to sort through, and God's helped me do it.
It keeps going on. You know, more that we learn more, and it opens us up to acting differently and changing our habits, and that opens us up more truth. Kind of like the interaction between the theological and cardinal virtues, right?
Right.
Our relationship with God opens us up to, you know, change in our life, and the more we change, the more we're open to God. And it just that journey continues, right? We've got about a minute and 50 seconds left. If there's somebody out there who's in a similar place to you were in terms of theological background, or maybe just probably, you know, most poignantly, like just stuck in the headspace, you know, and maybe they don't feel like they're getting anywhere, give them a word of encouragement on their journey of faith.
Oh, gosh.
Keep going.
Yeah, that's so much I could say. I guess it's, if I look back, I was very stubborn. And I just was not going to give up, you know. I needed to figure this out, you know. And the whole reason I got into philosophy is to figure out certain answers to theological questions. And I knew, I mean, at various points, I despaired of the possibility of truth, you know, or whether anything meant anything. But breaking through all that, and I guess the thing I would say is, again, Jesus says, you know, seek the truth and you'll find it. Just keep going at it, you know, and wherever you are in that journey to where you're going, Jesus is going to be there with you. Because I look in hindsight and I see it. Yeah. You know, at the time I didn't see it so clearly, but and then there's a lot of, again, people fall in different places after doing this search, you know, but But again, I think just stick with your journey, you know, and keep looking and be open to being corrected. Try to be humble, because I think I shot myself in the foot a lot of times by not being humble and thinking I was right. And it took a lot of breaking to get humble in certain respects. But just to try to be teachable and to expose yourself to different ways of thinking about things, and try to look at the all things considered best explanation for your lived experience and facts of empirical reality, you know. And that, I guess, is the way to go.
That's good. Good advice. Thanks.
Thank you,
Eric, for joining us. And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Dr. Eric Baldwin's story was an inspiration to you. We'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless you. See you then.